Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The former Democratic contender for Florida governor will face a hearing on possible violation of state ethics laws.
I think one of the problems is in this environment that we have honest politicians who are not constantly thinking forward about how things are going to look to the voters.
Also this week, Florida's Secretary of State is out after pictures of him in blackface suddenly surfaced.
I think it's unfortunate. I think he regrets that whole thing 14, 15 years ago.
We'll also visit the site of a deadly Florida shooting this week, get the latest on hurricane recovery efforts in the state's panhandle, and get a preview of education issues likely to show up before the legislature this year. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida's Commission on Ethics found probable cause to begin an investigation into possible state ethics violations by former Tallahassee mayor and Democratic candidate for Florida governor Andrew Gillum today. Probable cause does not mean Gillum is either guilty or innocent. Rather, it allows the commission to investigate the four issues brought before them. Robbie Gaffney was at today's commission proceeding and filed this report.
The four issues brought to the commission's attention were whether Gillum accepted tickets for the Broadway show Hamilton, as well as other accommodations. It is prohibited under state law for city officials to accept gifts from lobbyists. However, Gillum's attorney, Barry Richard, claims the case has no merit.
There's no allegation that he ever did anything for anybody in as a quid pro quo for receiving a gift.
Erwin Jackson, the Tallahassee businessman who initiated the commission's investigation into Gillum, said that he hoped the final decision will result in stricter punishment for ethical violations by government officials.
There's something really wrong with the Ethics Commission in here. All right. When Rick Fernandez was here, he was found guilty, and his penalty was a $6,000 fine. Now, what crooked politician is going to be opposed or concerned about maybe, if being found guilty, he might have to pay $6,000? As a private citizen, I'm paying a heck of a lot more than $6,000 to bring the case.
Jackson, a longtime City Hall critic, fully expects Gillum to ultimately face criminal charges.
I would suspect that he'll probably be looking at criminal charges on additional matters as well. So the month of January is not going to be good for Andrew Gillum.
The Ethics Commission will release a written statement regarding the hearing on January 30th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Florida's Secretary of State Mike Ertel resigned after the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper published pictures of the secretary in blackface. Sean Mulcahy says Jennifer Kennedy is serving in the interim.
Ertel lasted 16 days on the job before being forced out. The pictures obtained by the Tallahassee Democrat show him wearing blackface, lipstick, and a shirt that reads Katrina victim, referencing Hurricane Katrina. The photos were reportedly taken during a private 2005 Halloween party when Ertel was serving as Seminole County election supervisor. Governor Ron DeSantis told reporters during a stop in the panhandle he doesn't want his administration to be, in his own words, mired by side controversy.
I think it's unfortunate. I think he regrets, that whole thing 14, 15 years ago. But at the same time, you know, I want people to be able to lead and not have any of these things swirling around them. So I felt that it was best just move on.
In a short resignation letter to the governor, Ertel said, quote, "It has been an honor to serve you and the voters of Florida." But Ertel's resignation may not be adequate. In an interview with WMFE's Emily Lang, NAACP spokesman Malik Russell urged DeSantis to take a firm stance.
Racism functions as a sickness in our society, and it's important that politicians are not ambiguous in terms of where they stand against it.
Russell is calling on DeSantis to denounce Ertel's actions.
The act of accepting the resignation is not enough. Similar to what happened in Charlottesville, it's important to condemn the act.
The first scandal of the DeSantis administration came as a surprise. Ertel's appointment to the office had received bipartisan praise. While in his post in Seminole County, he expanded access to voting and campaigned to restore faith in the electoral process. Ertel's resignation also leaves questions. The legislature is grappling with implementing Amendment 4, which gave felons the right to vote, and ongoing legal challenges from the 2018 elections. But Leon County Supervisor of Elections Mark Early doesn't think Ertel's resignation will add to the problems.
I don't anticipate any real difficulties inherent upon the resignation of Secretary of State Ertel, primarily because I think he was not in office that long to really set a definitive course. And I think there's people in place that can move forward with that position and any initiatives that have been promulgated so far until there's a permanent Secretary of State appointed.
And as for Ertel's temporary replacement, Deputy Secretary of State Jennifer Kennedy, Early is confident she's suited for the post.
I think Jennifer Kennedy has a lot of experience with that position. She was an interim Secretary of State in the past, and I think she's well-versed in all the issues that that office is facing currently.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
A lot of personnel issues in state news this week. Mary Mayhew, Governor Ron DeSantis' choice to run the state agency for healthcare administration, started her job this week. She comes into the post at a critical time. Many recent moves the agency has taken on Medicaid have drawn fire from providers and people who work with poor Floridians. And one of those big changes begins in the next week. That's when ACA, as the agency is called, eliminates what is known as retroactive eligibility. That's a move that could adversely affect about 39,000 elderly and disabled people on Medicaid in Florida. Seema Verma, who's administrator of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and Mayhew's former boss, gave the state the green light to eliminate the longstanding policy of covering medical bills for 3 months to give people time to adjust to their new conditions. The approval came despite receiving more than 150 comments from the public opposing the change. Still to come on Capitol Report, Governor Ron DeSantis announced that President Donald Trump has extended the time period for 100% reimbursement for costs related to Hurricane Michael recovery. State Emergency Management Secretary Jared Moskowitz says it'll help local and state budgets.
This is hundreds of millions of dollars that is going to be relieved from our local governments and from our state budgets. That's the difference here.
Once again, it looks like education reform will be a hot topic during this year's Florida lawmaking session, although there also seems to be some support for making sure previous reforms are working before moving ahead to new ones.
Before you start looking at additional bold initiatives, new initiatives, let's make sure that what you already put in place is fully implemented.
And competing bills emerge over how to broaden access to dental care in Florida.
We came to discover that there are gross injustices in rural health care with respect to oral health care.
Before diving back into public policy and state government news, here are some late developments in the deadly shooting at a bank in Sebring this week. Authorities have confirmed the name of a fourth woman killed during that attack. The Highlands County Sheriff's Office said in a Facebook post today that 31-year-old Jessica Eileen Noreen Montague of Avon Park died Wednesday at the SunTrust branch in Sebring. Montague was one of four bank employees killed, along with one customer. Sheriff's Office spokesman Scott Dressel said a fifth bank employee was in a back break room when that attack began. He said the employee ran out a back door after hearing gunshots and also contacted law enforcement. Stephanie Colombini visited Sebring and says the people there never thought this would happen to them.
The day after the shooting, entry doors were still bashed in at the SunTrust Bank, where police vehicles broke down the barricaded doors. Yellow caution tape kept people from getting too close, but it didn't stop some residents from laying pink and purple flowers on the bushes surrounding the bank to pay respects to the female victims. Jim Jackemeyer rode his bike by the crime scene. He spends his winters in Sebring, but hails from Indiana, like confessed shooter Zephan Zaver.
You know, I feel for the people. We've got a real quiet community here, and we hate seeing things like this happen.
With a population of only about 10,000 residents, the city typically doesn't come up in national conversation, except for its famous 12 hours of Sebring auto race. Many residents and business owners in the area said they're not comfortable with the newfound attention, especially under such painful circumstances. At a salon next door to the bank, Joyce Waters shared her thoughts while she got her hair shampooed.
I grew up in Sebring and been here my whole life, and it's a tragedy to all of us.
She said she's frightened by the senselessness of Zaver's actions.
I just wish people were more aware of others who are so either challenged or confused or, I mean, like there had to be some implications that he was not sane, in my opinion.
After the shooting, an ex-girlfriend of Zaver's came forward and said he hated people. But his neighbor, Sharon Spillane, who's friends with Zaver's mother and would attend barbecues at their house, said she never imagined he could do something like this.
It's a little intimidating, it's a little scary to think that it's right next door. And I'd been in the house and I've had my daughter around him.
Zaver lived on a quiet street less than 10 minutes from the bank. Some houses were decorated with colorful lawn decorations like wind chimes and smiling plastic frogs. All along the block, American flags were flown at half-mast to mourn Zaver's victims. Spillane says it sends a clear message. This man does not represent this neighborhood.
Shooting five people, to me, is just unthinkable. It's just absolutely unthinkable. And Sebring's not going to ever be the same.
In the aftermath of the murders, there's been outcry on social media, calls to end gun violence with the hashtag another FL shooting. Tweets by state leaders like Governor Ron DeSantis and U.S. Senator Marco Rubio saying their prayers are with the victims were met by dozens of angry replies, arguing prayer isn't enough. But not all Sebring residents agree. Like Tim Williams. He's the brother-in-law of Anna Pignon Williams, one of the SunTrust Bank employees killed in the shooting. He spoke at a press conference after her identity was made public.
There are those who say that prayer is a useless act when tragedy such as this strikes. These same people argue that we need to pass new laws and exert more control over people. Our family rejects this ideology.
As does Sebring's snowbird Jim Jackemeyer, who says gun control wouldn't have stopped Zaver.
He could have used a knife, you know. He could have used a stick and beat him to death. So, no, I don't think that. I mean, obviously, the gun is an easy way to make sure they die, but I think we need to protect ourselves. And maybe if all those people had been carrying, that could have been slowed down a little bit or stopped.
Gun Violence Archive, a nonprofit that tracks shooting data, considers a mass shooting an incident where four or more people are injured or killed besides the shooter. The group says Sebring marks Florida's fifth mass shooting in January alone. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Sebring.
In a decision that was focused on expert witnesses, a state appeals court today rejected a medical malpractice lawsuit stemming from allegations that a woman suffered a broken femur during a hip replacement surgery. The patient, Sandra Dale Essex, filed the lawsuit in Osceola County against orthopedic surgeon Michael Carr and other defendants. Before filing medical malpractice lawsuits, plaintiffs are required under state law to submit written expert opinions to support their contentions of negligence, and the court turned all that aside. Now let's take a quick look ahead at the Tallahassee calendar. Lawmakers have been in the Capitol going over various bills that have been filed in advance of the upcoming legislative session, and they have now gone home, but with work intensifying in advance of that March 5th start of the lawmaking session, Florida Senate committees are scheduled to meet over 4 days in early February, while House panels will meet over 3 days. Those meetings will come back during the week that starts February 4th. Although not very large in terms of geographic spread, Hurricane Michael brought a powerful blow to the Florida Panhandle. Since communities in the target area have been struggling to find funds to pay for the debris cleanup, even with help from the federal government, Blaise Ganey reports the announcement that the feds will be providing more funding has removed some of the burden on local governments.
As Hurricane Michael was hitting the panhandle, in an interview with Fox News, the then gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis described what he was doing for the impacted communities.
I had public rallies scheduled yesterday and today. We converted those into supply drives. So the campaign, we rented a U-Haul and we had people come and bring water, non-perishable food, baby supplies, things like that.
Since becoming governor, he hasn't stopped.
When I became governor, I said, this is something we've got to act on. So we listened to people, we understood some of the problems, and then we came back the second week and addressed some of them. We awarded money to Mexico Beach, who just been overrun with debris.
On January 16th, the governor ordered the Department of Emergency Management Director Jared Moskowitz to find ways to expedite funding. Moskowitz says it's already in the works.
We at DEM are looking at every policy, every procedure. We have already changed our entire process for Hurricane Michael, which will roll out in the beginning of February.
That process will help expedite 50% of the money needed for a recovery project up front, which Moskowitz says will help those impacted by other recent hurricanes also.
We will not only do that here, but we will also go back to the folks that are still dealing with Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Matthew and are still waiting for relief from DEM. And we will be providing the same sort of programs that we are providing here for those folks as well.
But even with that, the hardest hit communities like Mexico Beach would still struggle to cover the rebuilding costs. The governor said the local government there has about $3 million in its annual budget, but the actual debris cleanup is expected to need nearly $80 million. On January 22nd, DeSantis met with President Donald Trump after sending him a letter asking to extend the period of 100% federal reimbursement. The president had earlier agreed to have the federal government cover 5 days.
After meeting with the president on Tuesday, he agreed to extend that period of 100% reimbursement from 5 days to 45 days.
State Emergency Director Moskowitz says this will make a significant impact to all of storm-impacted Florida.
This is hundreds of millions of dollars that is going to be relieved from our local governments and from our state budgets. That's the difference here.
With the guarantee of more funding, recovery efforts are looking brighter. But DeSantis says if he sees the need for more, he knows where to go.
We thank President Trump. He heard, he listened, and he acted. And I don't think you can ask much more than a president that's willing to do it. And there's other things that we may go to him and he's interested in remaining engaged.
One relatively minor letdown, in the original letter Governor DeSantis wrote President Trump, he had also asked for the federal cost share to be increased to 90% instead of the current 50. That was denied. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaise Ganey.
Discussions concerning hot topics in Florida public education are underway ahead of the coming legislative session, from school safety to leadership positions. Ryan Daly gives a look back at this week's developments.
On January 22nd, the State Senate Committee on Education heard from Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, chair of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission. He told the committee districts around the state have not been complying fully with the Florida legislature's 2018 school safety bill.
There is not the right sense of urgency. There's not the right sense of moving the needle fast enough and far enough. And these districts have to comply with what you all put in law. And there are a number of things that just haven't been done.
The sheriff and commission chair used the example of behavioral threat assessment teams, multidisciplinary groups made up of law enforcement and various school staff on every campus.
One of the school boards in the state is having a discussion about whether it's a good idea to have threat assessment teams. Seriously? It's in the law that you will have them, and they're having a discussion about whether they think they should have them.
One reason Gualtieri says some districts aren't falling into line is a lack of enforcement potency in the Department of Education's Office of Safe Schools.
The problem is, with a lot of this, is the Department of Education and the commissioner lack oversight authority. What you all put into 7026 is saying the Office of Safe Schools shall have oversight authority. But they have no compliance authority. There's no teeth to it.
Gualtieri asked Senate members to make sure districts are in compliance before legislating further change.
Before you start looking at additional bold initiatives, new initiatives, let's make sure that what you already put in place is fully implemented and is making the difference that you intended that it make.
Elsewhere in Florida's public education landscape, Democratic State Senator Janet Cruz wants voters to decide who heads Florida's Department of Education going forward. Cruz filed a resolution for the coming session that would become a constitutional ballot initiative if enacted. Voters could then have their say in the 2020 election as to whether the state education commissioner becomes an elected position. A 60% vote in 2020 would have Florida voters choosing a commissioner starting in the 2022 election. If it becomes an elected position, the commissioner would be a member of the Florida cabinet. The State Board of Education, made up of governor appointees, currently votes on who becomes commissioner. In December, the state board voted former Republican Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran in to helm DOE. Corcoran has long been an advocate for school choice in the state. Last month, he faced questions from the state board about possible conflicts of interest concerning charter schools, which Corcoran vehemently denied. Speaking at a meeting of Tallahassee's network of entrepreneurs and business advocates, State Senator Bill Monford gave his opinion on public education funding in charter schools Tuesday.
If we're not careful, we're going to wind up with two separate public education systems.
Monford says he supported charter schools at their advent, seeing them as an outlet for students living in underperforming districts. Now he says he fears the scales are uneven when it comes to dollars.
If we're not careful, we're going to have an imbalance, especially from a financial standpoint.
And the state senator's commentary didn't stop there.
But what we've done is we've slipped, I believe, too far to the profit motive, if you will. There are a lot of companies making a lot of money off of charter schools.
Monford says he and his colleagues need to insist traditional public schools are funded adequately.
We've got a lot of work to do, the state does, to clean up the mess that we've created in a lot of ways for public education.
Monford currently serves as CEO of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Well, there never seems to be any lack of bad environmental news, so it's kind of refreshing when you get a piece of positive news, and here is just such a piece. Researchers have reported seeing three rare right whale calves off of Florida's Atlantic coast. Philip Hamilton, he's with the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, says the calves are, in his words, a spark of hope for the critically endangered marine mammals. The Daytona Beach News Journal reports that Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission researchers have spotted three pairs of mothers and calves since late December in the waters between Fernandina Beach and Ponte Vedra Beach. Right whales typically migrate from the North Atlantic to give birth off the coasts of Georgia and Florida from December through March. Scientists estimate only about 450 North Atlantic right whales remain. No newborns were spotted during the last calving season, and just five calves were counted during the previous year. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, we wrap up this episode of Capitol Report with a figurative trip to the dentist, or to the new classification of dental professionals who one day might be able to perform some of the functions traditionally limited to dentists in Florida. Lawmakers are being asked to consider two competing proposals surrounding access to dental care. One would allow mid-level practitioners to be licensed, while the other would provide incentives to would-be dentists. Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan has that story.
A coalition called Floridians for Dental Access wants lawmakers to allow licenses for dental therapists. They have more training than a dental hygienist and less training than a dentist. They can perform services like filling cavities and pulling teeth. St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandes is pushing for the new license.
We have counties with no practicing dentists in those counties. We have millions of people who are underserved in this space. And this creates us, for us, an opportunity to lead in the country by allowing dental therapists and to grow a new profession and create a new pathway for individuals in the state.
His plea to reporters at the Capitol came as the James Madison Institute, a Tallahassee think tank, issued a policy brief focused on the need for dental therapists all over Florida.
63 of the 67 counties have areas within the county that are designated as shortage areas for oral health care.
Sal Nuzzo is the Institute's vice president of policy and co-author of the report. He says there aren't enough dentists in Florida, and too few of them accept Medicaid, so dental therapists could help fill the gap.
Mid-level providers are also able to provide that maintenance and restorative care at a far lower cost than a traditional dentist. So if you're just above the Medicaid levels, but you don't have traditional dental insurance, you're able to get care at a much better rate.
Nuzzo says there are areas of Florida where a dentist can't be found within a one-hour drive. The issue got his attention when he heard about a 12-year-old Maryland boy on Medicaid who couldn't get treatment for a tooth infection, and a trip to the ER couldn't save him.
The infection had spread to his brain, and he subsequently passed away. And that story just stuck with me. So we began to look at what are the policy implications behind this. And we came to discover that there are gross injustices in rural healthcare with respect to oral healthcare.
The Florida Dental Association is supporting a different proposal. Chief Legislative Officer Joanne Hart says the bill will help dentists who are just starting out and fulfill the needs of those on Medicaid.
The bill creates a dental student loan repayment program that will incentivize dentists to go into these underserved areas and work as full-time Medicaid providers. And the return on the investment for the state will be great because it will help reduce occurrences in emergency room where we know they aren't getting definitive care, only pain meds and antibiotics.
Hart says creating a licensing program for a new type of dental provider will increase regulations and costs. And she says mid-level providers can't compete with a dentist's level of knowledge.
Dental therapists are high school graduates that get 3 years of dental therapy training and then would be authorized to do irreversible surgical procedures such as extractions, partial root canals, and local anesthesia. What they are not trained, as dentists are, is to look at other conditions related to an individual's medical health and to make sure that whatever is happening in their dental procedures does not impact their overall health.
The James Madison Institute report cites federal data showing more than 5.5 million Floridians live in areas with documented dentist shortages. If approved, dental therapists would work under the supervision of a dentist without that dentist having to be in the office. Dental therapists would be trained to perform approximately 100 procedures, twice as many as a dental hygienist. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank Robbie Gaffney and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.